It's Tuesday, May 17th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Hello and welcome. Coming up, plans are made to help Libya's new government fight Islamic State.
The caliphate, as they call it, this perverse caliphate, is shrinking. So they are very much on the defensive.
Islamic State is being hit hard in Iraq and Syria. A big investor makes a big buy. Also ahead, China's cultural revolution and the little red book behind it. It's all on today's International Edition. World powers say they will back Libya's new government in its bid to lift a UN arms embargo, a move that could help the government combat internal security threats and fight Islamic State. Secretary of State John Kerry announced the decision following a multi-nation meeting in Vienna, Austria, chaired by the United States and Italy.
We're not talking about troops and boots and that kind of intervention. We continue right now to assess the ISIL activity that's taking place, and we're working with our partners to determine the best way forward to help Libya to be able to deal with that threat.
VOA State Department correspondent Pam Dawkins is traveling with Secretary Kerry and tells more about what the meeting produced to International Edition host Susan Yaki.
Well, there were several outcomes. First of all, Kerry said that the international community will support Libya's Presidency Council as it seeks an exemption from the UN arms embargo to acquire those weapons and bullets that it needs to fight Daesh and other terrorist groups. He also said there was a need for accelerated humanitarian aid to Libya. In addition to the U.S., Italy, and Libya, there are 19 other countries that were represented. These are regional countries that were represented today, along with officials from the African Union, the Arab League, the European Union, and the UN. The entire group relayed a joint communique at the end of talks. And in this communique, the group said that it was committed to supporting all efforts of the Libyan government to enhance its political outreach throughout the country.
Could you tell us a little bit more about the challenges Libya is currently facing?
Yes, Libya's prime minister described the situation in his country as very bad, saying Libya is facing both economic and security challenges. He said Libya is seeking more international assistance for training and equipping its forces. He was not specific, but said he would provide a list of what was needed as soon as the UN arms embargo was lifted. The country, of course, continues to face a challenge from the Islamic State, which has set up a base in Libya and used that base to launch attacks in countries including neighboring Tunisia. Kerry said the international community was working with Libya to respond to the terrorist threat posed by Daesh.
Well, what is next for these diplomats on Libya? Do they plan to meet again? Where's this go?
Well, the work to support Libya will continue at the UN as well as in the U.S. and the regional countries that were present today. The U.S., on its part, pledged to continue to support Libya in terms of security cooperation and humanitarian assistance.
The internationally recognized Government of National Accord is facing challenges from rival factions and Islamic State affiliate militants who have established a base in the central city of Sirte and have used that base to launch attacks into neighboring Tunisia. We turn now to what's trending online, and to do that, we have our social media correspondent, G. Abby Lee, right here in our studio. Hello, G.
Hi, Jim.
What are we talking about today?
There are two stories from the tech industry. There is a story on Apple stocks and a speech by Sheryl Sandberg, who is the chief operating officer or COO of Facebook. Let's begin with Apple. Mm-hmm. Investor Warren Buffett purchased 9.8 million shares during the first quarter of this year, and that's great news for Apple shares that have gone down more than 10% so far this year. And that news is giving a boost to the share's popularity.
Absolutely, and we'll talk a little bit more about that in the program. What's the reaction like this online?
Well, surprisingly, people are still quite cautious. One person commented on a Facebook post by the Wall Street Journal that if you do choose to own it, It should only make up a small piece of a well-diversified portfolio.
And that's good advice, so much like any other stocks. Let's move on to the Facebook story. What's the buzz there?
So Sandberg gave the commencement speech at the University of California, Berkeley over the weekend, and naturally she live-streamed it through Facebook Live. Almost 2.5 million people viewed it around the world. She made very candid comments about her emotional struggles following the death of her husband last year. He was the CEO of an online software company called SurveyMonkey, and he passed away during their vacation in Mexico on a treadmill, and that was very tragic. She said losing her husband helped her find deeper gratitude. Facebook founder and CEO Mark Zuckerberg was one of the first to comment. He wrote, "Beautiful and inspirational. Thank you." And many other notable Facebook users also left comments. And all in all, more than 6,000 people left comments to their live stream.
Wow, a big buzz there. What else is trending?
Of course, U.S. presidential race. Democratic contender Hillary Clinton said her husband would be in charge of stimulating the economy if and when she is elected. On the GOP side, former contender Ben Carson named Sarah Palin, Ted Cruz, John Kasich, Marco Rubio, and Chris Christie as potential VP nominees for Donald Trump. Jim?
Well, that's a great wrap-up. Thank you so much, G. If you have questions or comments, you can feel free to tweet those, too, at @VOA_IE. And if you like, you may also tag myself and G on those tweets. It's @GAbbyLee and @VOA Stevenson. Here are some of the top stories that are trending now in Asia. Next Philippines president wants death sentences by hanging. China silent on 50th anniversary of Cultural Revolution. Afghan minority group protests power line reroute. Looming vote on basic law worries Thai economists. And re-election of exiled prime minister spurs hope for renewed Tibet talks. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and much more on our website at voanews.com and also through our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. President Obama's special envoy in the Coalition Against Islamic State said Sunday the militant group has resorted to suicide attacks in Iraq because they are on the defensive and the territory that they control is shrinking. Terrorism analyst Greg Barton of Australia's Deakin University tells VOA's Victor Beatty that overall, the Islamic State is on the defensive, but much of the land that they've given up is not very significant.
The fact that they've lost a quarter of their territory on the ground doesn't necessarily tell you entirely how the war is going. The important loss of territory is that northern border strip, northern Syria, along the Turkish border. Of course, they famously took the city of Ramadi and they've lost it again, but retaking Ramadi cost the Iraqis the destruction of the city. The big question now is how do you take cities like Mosul and Raqqa back without horrible things happening to the people who are effectively the millions, literally millions in those two cities who are effectively hostages held against their own will. That's the dilemma. So, yes, Islamic State is on the back foot, and they've been on the back foot for some time. Of course, as was noted in the article about McGurk, we are seeing a corresponding expansion of Islamic State activity into areas like Libya, into the Sinai, even now a stronger and apparently more meaningful coalition with Boko Haram in Nigeria. So all the indicators suggest this is a long, difficult struggle ahead.
He's talked about making progress in an offensive against both Raqqa in Syria and Mosul in Iraq, as you've mentioned. What progress is he referring to? Those cities are still under IS control.
One sign of progress we do see is successful airstrikes on the outskirts of those cities. I mean, there was an airstrike last week in the outskirts of Mosul that was very significant. And the significance of that is that you don't do airstrikes on occupied cities unless you've got intelligence on the ground to guide you in very specifically and avoid hitting civilians. So that suggests there's probably been some gains on the ground in terms of infiltration by intelligence, by Iraqi and allied intelligence, and a sense of preparatory work for the eventual retaking of those cities. But, you know, in the case of Raqqa, so much depends upon the peace negotiations in Syria. And in the case of Iraq, whilst you have a stable government at one level, the occupation of the Green Zone the other week points to the fact that it's a very unpopular government that's struggling to maintain credibility. So politics will probably determine when those campaigns against Islamic State strongholds in Raqqa and Mosul can go ahead.
McGurk also talked about the round-the-clock anti-IS propaganda campaign involving companies such as Facebook and YouTube. He said, quote, for every pro-Daesh Twitter handle, there are now six calling out its lies and countering its message. Is there progress on that front?
There's certainly progress. I'm not entirely persuaded that we're sort of making a 6-to-1 ratio. I suspect actually that can't be true, given the enormous number of pro-Daesh Twitter handles out there and other social media presences. I mean, we're closing the gap. The gap was enormous. They basically played on that territory unchallenged. Now they are facing challenges, and it's good that major companies like Facebook, YouTube are getting into that space, and civil society is as well.
Greg Barton says given the enormity and complexity of the task, he doubts the cities of Mosul or Raqqa will be retaken from the IS group anytime before 2018. U.S. financial markets are on the move again, up about 1% thanks to news about disruptions in Nigeria's oil production. That has dampened concerns about a prolonged glut of oil on world markets. Investors are also encouraged by a large stock purchase by one of the biggest names out there. VOA financial correspondent Jill Malandrino joins us from New York as we learn Warren Buffett now owns a chunk of Apple.
Yeah, according to a regulatory filing, he put about $1 billion into the position. It's the first time ever that he's had a position in the iPhone maker. Shares were trading just about 2% higher on the news, and this took the Nasdaq up higher following 4 weeks of losses because of recent weakness in Apple. So Buffett, the regulatory filing says that he bought these shares prior to March 31st. Since then, Apple has taken about a $16 haircut, with the exception of today's trading. Going into trade last Friday, Apple was actually down 14% on the year. So if retail investors took the opportunity to piggyback on the news out of Berkshire Hathaway, they got an even better deal than he did. The biggest concerns with Apple right now is the iPhone 7 replacement cycle has investors questioning whether Apple itself is expecting the iPhone 7 to decline significantly from the 6S. Sentiment right now is pretty negative about the replacement cycle because the question is, what's new with the 7 that I absolutely have to get when my 6 still works? And in many cases, a lot of people still have their 5s. So that's really what the question is right now. But it's interesting, with Buffett getting in at what seems to be around the highs, David Tepper's Appaloosa Management disclosed last week they blew out of their Apple position. Tiger Asset Management today, it broke around 12 o'clock today, that they got out of their position. Carl Icahn, another well-known investor, got out of his position. So it's interesting that these are all happening at once. And, you know, part of the concerns with Apple, in addition to the replacement cycle, is declining sales in China. Now, Tim Cook is in Beijing this week, making the rounds there, trying to improve relationships and sales over in China. So there's so many different types of activity going on in Apple. So it really is anyone's guess right now.
Warren Buffett has not been a big tech investor, but clearly he thinks he sees something in there that others don't.
Right. Well, you know what? He also increased his stake in IBM. These are two names that have been beaten down, whereas some stocks in the tech sector have done really, really well. And it could be, again, you can't be a growth stock forever. Right now, the focus is on Facebook. It's on an Amazon, which are the leaders in the market right now. So perhaps Buffett is seeing that there is some value here, which is his classical fundamental way of investing.
Well, maybe he's just turning in his flip phone. Let's flip to oil. What's happening with oil in the markets? I understand that the financial markets are up on some news.
Oh, yeah. Crude oil prices jumped over 2% to almost $49 this morning, which is the highest that we've seen it since November. Part of the reason is ongoing and growing concerns about Nigerian output disruptions. But the real bull case today was Goldman Sachs. They've been a longtime bear. For about 2 years, they've been negative on the crude oil complex. They said in a note this morning that the years of oil supply glut are now actually in a deficit. So energy shares were obviously leading the way in early trade today, and it's really what's taking up the Dow and S&P throughout the entire session. But one thing, you have to read the entire note. You're just getting the headline here. They are actually seeing that we will have a supply glut towards the end of 2016 and 2017. So it's very curious, the timing, as we're going into Memorial Day, peak driving, and sort of all this bullish news is coming out. So I find the timing a little bit curious, not to get too conspiracy theory on you, but it provided a nice bid into the market. And, you know, we'll see if that continues or if this was just a one-day type of event. But this Apple story is really going to be something interesting to follow as well.
Always interesting in the stories that we hear from Jill Malandrino in New York. Jill, thanks so much for joining us.
Okay, thank you.
Can you imagine buying almost 10 million shares of Apple? Wow. Well, if you want to read more about it, you may visit the voanews.com website and be sure to follow us on Twitter at @VOA_IE and like us on Facebook at VOA Now. You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
Hi, I'm Larry London, and I'm the host of Border Crossings, inviting you to join me for one of the best hours of request music possible on the radio. We've got all your favorite songs by your favorite singers. You tell us what to play. It's requests and dedications, and it happens every weekday right here on The Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. 50 years ago, the Chinese Communist Party started the country down a path to the Cultural Revolution, which it said would bring about a more just society, but in practice led to complete social and economic disaster. The seemingly momentous anniversary was all but ignored and met with virtual silence from China's state-run media. On May 16, 1966, Chinese Communist Party Chairman Mao Zedong began the campaign by purging several top party officials and announcing his agenda that ostensibly sought to return power to the working class that had been usurped by the bourgeois. But one of the most powerful symbols used to promote Mao's grip on the nation was the Little Red Book. Alexander Cook, assistant professor of history at the University of California, Berkeley, author and editor of the book, Mao's Little Red Book, A Global History, describes the big impact of the small text.
The book is 50 years old. It definitely belongs to a bygone era, but it still has a little bit of residual power to it. It's a lightning rod for opinion. This is a book that gets translated into about 36 languages officially, unofficially, more like 50 languages. It's a book that takes on a life of its own and the history of all of these different nations around the world, and it's used in different ways.
Presumably at the time, Mao was a little bit busy. He comes out with this book. How did he accomplish that?
Mao himself had very little to do with the actual creation of the book. It emerges in the early 1960s in China. It emerges from the military. The idea from it came from journalists inside the army. The editors and publishers of military newspapers kind of got into the habit of printing Mao quotations in the masthead of their newspapers. Then they started thinking, well, the quotation should fit whatever the lead news story is. So they needed kind of a topical index of quotations relating to all different kinds of situations and stories that might appear in the paper. And then from there, they created this kind of card catalog, and they got the idea to compile it together into a kind of a field manual for the soldiers. It's the field manual origins of the book that actually explain its peculiar little size. It has to fit into the breast pocket of an army uniform, and the famous red vinyl cover, which makes it waterproof. So it's really just designed to be convenient for a soldier to carry around little quick reference guide. If you want to find an inspirational quotation on a particular topic, you pull it out of your pocket, open it up to the appropriate chapter, and 10 seconds later, you've got a Mao quote.
It is the internet or the text message of the day.
It really is. One of our contributors, Andrew Jones, who's also a professor at UC Berkeley, has a really interesting chapter on comparing the quotation to the sort of 60s phenomenon, pop song, musical hook. The book is portable, but the quotations in a way are kind of portable. They're kind of memorable. A lot of them would fit into a Twitter. They're just like little snippets that are easily movable and easily transmittable about. In Marxism, there's a longstanding criticism of capitalism and of commodity culture. This is kind of an instance where a really radical form of Marxism intersects with commodity culture.
And very iconic even to this day, as tourists can go around Beijing and other areas and see the little red book being sold in stalls.
Oh, very much so. I mean, you can buy the little red book today in China. It's a very popular tourist item. I think Chinese people feel a little bit more conflicted about it in a way. It's ubiquitous, but it's the kind of thing people keep in the bottom of a drawer, you know, maybe tied up with a lot of ambivalent kind of memories and nostalgia. The thing you don't really want to look at, but you can't quite throw away, it still has that kind of a power in China today. But the meaning of the book is really, I think, has changed over time. There's always kind of been this tension between the Little Red Book as something dangerous, subversive, but also kind of a comical pop culture light feeling about it.
The communist utopia Mao had planned instead became a brutal period of violence, food shortage, and economic hardship that led to the persecution and death of millions of people. Now it seems as if the Chinese government would rather forget the Cultural Revolution entirely. There were no official events held Monday, and no newspapers on mainland China made mention of the anniversary. You've been listening to International Edition. You can find us at our website, voanews.com. We invite you to like us on Facebook, VOA Now, and follow us on Twitter at @VOA_IE. Our director is Tracy Carter, engineer Jim Harmon. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. Thanks so much for spending a little part of your day with us, and we hope the rest of it goes very well for you.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Under the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action agreed to by the European Union, the P5+1 countries, and Iran, nuclear-related sanctions imposed on Iran were lifted in exchange for Iran's taking a series of verifiable steps that prevent Iran from acquiring a nuclear weapon and ensure its nuclear program will be exclusively peaceful. U.S. officials have said that so far Iran has fulfilled its commitments under the JCPOA, as the plan is called. But Iranian leaders have complained that the economic benefits Iran was to receive after the nuclear-related sanctions were removed have not materialized. Some banks and corporations have expressed reluctance to do business with Iran for fear of transgressing sanctions that remain in place. To clarify what business is now permitted under the JCPOA, Secretary of State John Kerry and representatives of the U.S. Treasury Department met in London with several top executives from European banks. Secretary Kerry said the purpose of the meeting was to put to rest misinterpretations or mere rumors about how this is applied. We want to make it clear that legitimate business, which is clear under the definition of the agreement, is available to the banks, he said, as long as they do their normal due diligence and know who they're dealing with. They're not going to be held to some undefined and inappropriate standard. Secretary Kerry added, this was really an effort to listen to the bankers, to hear from them what their perceptions are, the hurdles that they see to moving, and to be able to address those as directly as we can, and define for them our interpretation of the law and of the standards, so that there's a clarity going forward, and, hopefully, an ability to do those things that are meant to be done under the agreement. Secretary Kerry said both sides have an obligation to live up to this agreement, and both sides need to get the benefit of the agreement. Our benefit is that we see a nuclear program that is now visible, open to inspection, understandable, restrained, and living up to the standards of the International Atomic Energy Agency. And they have an expectation that the sanctions that were supposed to be lifted are in fact lifted, and that the implementation is appropriate.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.